tax-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the corporation that people just seem to love to hate. This is a company that is, in fact, the largest corporation in the world. It's also the largest retailer in the world, and the largest grocer in the world, and the largest jeweler in the world. It's the owner of the nation's largest private trucking fleet and the largest private employer in the United States and Mexico and Canada. It's Walmart. This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with the writer John Dicker, who is author of a recently published book that looks at the company and how it is we feel the way we do about it. It's titled The United States of Walmart, and the book is published by Tarcher Penguin. John Dicker is a writer based in Denver. His work's been published in The Nation, in Salon, and many alternative news weeklies, and takes a look at how it is that this company came to be the world's largest retailer and the largest private employer in America. Certainly, it's a company that's been criticized for destroying smaller competitors, for creating jobs but low-paying jobs, and also for fighting efforts to organize workers. Few American corporations have attracted as much admiration or as much anger as Walmart has. And given the number of people that are unhappy about Walmart and would swear to you that they would never shop there, Americans in large numbers do shop there. They are attracted by low prices. We'll sort some of this out this morning as we talk with John Dicker, and questions, of course, are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. And we do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 locally, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly anyone is welcome to call with questions, comments. The only thing we ask of callers is just that people try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But anyone listening, it's welcome to call. John Dicker, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, David.
Well, thanks for being with us. We certainly appreciate it. What led your interest to want to spend a lot of time thinking about and doing a longer piece like this, ultimately representing, resulting in the book, about Walmart?
Well, I'd been contacted by an editor at Tarcher, which is an imprint of Penguin. They'd read a couple of pieces that I wrote. One was about Walmart and the union campaign, which at the time in 2002 was centered around the city of Las Vegas. This was at the time where the United Food and Commercial Workers was going to make its, you know, great stand against the giant retailer, because it's a kind of town with a lot of union density and union political power. So I'd written about that, and then I'd also written other couple of pieces about just kind of labor-related stuff, and they just asked me if I was interested in writing a book about the Walmartization of America.
Mm-hmm.
So it was as simple as that.
It's stunning when you I'm sure will not come as news to people, but when you start listing these sorts of facts that tell you just how big Walmart is and how dominant it is in retailing, like the fact that it's now the biggest retail jeweler in the world, and it's the largest retailer in the world, and it's the largest grocer in the world. And you can just pile these kind of statistics one on top of another to get to the point where you get almost a little bit numb.
Yeah, I mean, as I say in the book, it's kind of a shift for people in the way they think of about big business. Because normally we're accustomed to thinking of large corporations as, you know, the places that would have a big office downtown and a big boardroom table and would actually, you know, plunder things from the earth or actually make products. And Walmart, you know, doesn't really do that. They're if you grew up in sort of Walmart country, which is states like Arkansas and Missouri and Texas and Florida and Oklahoma, you know, it's hard to believe that a store that's probably been with you your whole life is now suddenly in the news all the time. It's kind of like a paradigm shift that a large retailer rather than a large manufacturer is really kind of the precedent-setting company and kind of this template for big business. Mm-hmm. And the way it's done in the new millennium.
It's not Walmart. Certainly, is not the. It may be the dominant one, but it's not the only major national retail chain. I mean, there are others that you can name. Is Walmart really so different? Is Walmart really so different than Home Depot or Kmart or Sears or any other big box retailer that you could think of?
Well, it is in the terms of as a business leader, it kind of sets precedents and it sets standards. The University of California professor Nelson Lichtenstein has called it, the template company and compared it to GM in the 40s. And really, GM set a standard by, negotiating with labor unions and really providing sort of these, middle-class jobs for people who otherwise might not have them. And Walmart, not so much. But, your larger question is how different is Walmart than Target or Kmart or some of the other big box competitors? You just have to look at its sales and the number of stores. Target, which is, going into supercenters, which a supercenter you probably know is just a general merchandise store with a grocery store added into it. And what that does is, it gets people who are, it creates a one-stop shopping environment. And it gets people who might have needed a quart of milk to go over into electronics, pick up a CD. You know what I mean? You can and suddenly realize that they needed some kitchen items. They go into kitchen. And it basically, you sell more per square foot in a larger store like that. And these are the stores that are, anywhere between 140 to sometimes 220,000 square feet of retail space. But Target, for instance, has about 140 supercenters. Walmart has about 2,000 in the U.S. So they're not on the same playing field, even though they look very similar. And if you drive kind of on the proverbial American strip mall, you might not think that they're that different.
Well, I guess that points at something that has been a trend in retailing in recent years, and that is trying to get people into your store and then give them the opportunity to buy as many different kinds of things with one stop as possible. It's like you say, a place where you can buy produce, you can buy a DVD player, you can buy blue jeans, you can buy a new set of tires and have them put them on the car, that kind of thing. It's not a new trend, but it sounds as if do we owe that to Walmart?
I that's a good question, and I'm not sure I know, who was the first person to decide, what was the first retailer to try to do something, really beyond their scope to keep people in the store. I mean, you could look back in the history of Walmart when Sam Walton was just a franchisee, and he would do things that at the time were pretty kind of radical in a small Arkansas town for a five-and-dime store owner, for instance. And this would seem like nothing now, but he would take a popcorn machine and put it outside on the street to lure people in. With popcorn. He didn't really sell food, but having a popcorn machine, certainly draws crowds. Later, he upped the ante, took out a loan, and got a soft serve ice cream machine. These are little things. I don't know that, I don't know that he's the first person to do that, but Walmart does it, really well these days. One of the things that, their Walmart TV network has a larger viewership than all three major networks. People aren't going to tune in for as long, but they will watch it when they're in the store. And so what you'll have, Walmart calls this, they call it retailtainment. And so you'll have like a Hanson concert on Walmart's TV screens on election night in the 2004 presidential elections. You could watch the returns on Fox News throughout Walmart on the monitors. They do things like they'll have anyone from Paris Hilton actually signed copies of her book at a L.A. Walmart, and the author Nicholas Sparks will sign copies. Both Clintons, Hillary and Bill, have had book events at Walmart's. So there's all sorts of stuff going on there, and it's just not that hard to figure out. It's get people to the store, and the more time they're there, the more money they'll spend there.
Yeah. Of all the people that I would not expect to meet in Walmart, I think Paris Hilton would be pretty much near the top of the list. The Clintons, maybe.
Right. Well, Clintons have a long relationship with Walmart because they're both, Walmart is an Arkansas-based company, and, the Waltons were very tight with the Clintons when Bill was governor of Arkansas for all those years. And Hillary Clinton, it should be noted, was the first woman to serve on Walmart's board of directors, which she held until her husband got elected president. And so, people who are wondering, a lot of people try to look at the Walmart issue politically because the company has started to donate a lot of money and has started to become active as a lobbyist, as a, you know, in Washington doing lobbying. But if you look and try to think, well, you know, certainly the Democrats will align against Walmart. That's, you know, I don't predict that. You know, Hillary Clinton, Evan Bayh, and several other leading Democrats, you know, receive money from Walmart's PAC. So it's very interesting, and that's another reason why Walmart is turning into a bigger and bigger story, because they're part of the political landscape now.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Dicker. His book is The United States of Walmart. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. Questions welcome. In fact, we have several people lined up here and ready to go. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we'll start with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I thought that Ted told me line two. Well, at any rate, would it be logical to promote a boycott of Walmart in order to put pressure on China, because China recently welcomed the dictator of Zimbabwe just after he had destroyed shanty towns of 750,000 people? And this is condoning a ruthless dictator, and since Walmart is their chief merchant, I was thinking maybe a boycott would be in order, so that they that would deter China from doing things such as welcoming ruthless dictators such as the president of Zimbabwe. To get my point, it's a little bit convoluted.
Sure. I don't know how, you know, Walmart is a very difficult company to organize a boycott, and boycotts in general are very difficult to organize. I'm not really an activist, so it's not my, you know, my place to say, you know, to prescribe what people should do politically. But I know, you know, Walmart is obviously receptive, though they often don't seem like it, to the political environment and the concerns of their customers. And certainly, if people didn't go there or didn't made a point not to shop there, and they did it in large enough numbers, Walmart would have to react. But you're talking about a company that I think about 35 million people, you know, shop at each week. I could be wrong on that number, but you know, so the idea, and especially, you know, in areas where Walmart is the only game in town, or for people whose income kind of dictates that they have to shop at Walmart, it's tricky. It's a tricky dynamic. I mean, are you really going to tell people who live, you know, paycheck to paycheck that they need to not, you know, get their bread and eggs at Walmart for this larger political point? So it's an incredibly complex question.
Doesn't Walmart undermine workers' rights, though, by taking money or taking goods from China without any acknowledgement of workers' rights?
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. You know, other companies have been responsive to public pressure campaigns. For instance, The Gap has allowed, you know, independent human rights monitors into their factories, and even last year published a report criticizing themselves and their record, you know, with the conditions in their factories in Central America. Walmart has never allowed any, you know, they've never disclosed where their production facilities are, and they'll say, well, we don't have production facilities, we contract out to them. But, you know, this is a company that has that's built itself on mastering data. They know if a banana sold in Shenzhen, China, an hour ago, it's tallied in their Bentonville, you know, computer. But they've always said, well, you know, we can't disclose this. And then they've said, you know, human rights monitors are people with agendas. So they're very resistant to doing this. But I think, you know, certainly, you know, the offshoring trend and the outsourcing trend is certainly hurting, you know, American workers, especially, you know, in places like, take Kannapolis, North Carolina, where the textile town is basically like a ghost town. But the problem, I think, what a lot of, you know, people who work on this issue from a human rights perspective would say is that, you know, the question at this point isn't about getting kind of manufacturing jobs to come back from China. That's a very unrealistic goal. That ship has kind of sailed. The question is holding these large corporations accountable to what they do over there in the developing world.
Thank you.
All right. Well, this gets at this issue of how it is that people, and I'm sure that there are significant numbers of them, how it is that they express their unhappiness with this company, with Walmart. There are a lot of people who are unhappy with Walmart because of the way that it treats its workers, because it won't let them unionize, because the company has put smaller retailers, particularly independent retailers, out of business, and on and on. They have their reasons. And I'm sure probably all of us know, a lot of us know, people who would say, I refuse to shop there. I just won't go there. But as you say, very, very large numbers of Americans do, and in part because it might be the only opportunity, and it also might be because they're compelled to go where they can get the best product they can for the lowest price they can. So given the size of the company, is it reasonable to think that any kind of organized effort by people who are unhappy with the company and its policies could possibly be successful?
I would hesitate to say that that there's nothing you can do, and there's nothing people can do, because every sort of social dynamic, you could have said that about apartheid in South Africa, that it would never be overcome. You could have said that about segregation and Jim Crow in this country. You know what I mean? There's I hate to resort to cliches, but the harder they come, the harder they fall. But it's an incredibly complex dynamic, because one of the things Walmart does that's smart in its PR is that they mention that their core customer is someone who lives paycheck to paycheck. And so, as I write in the book, the question is, how do you explain to, if you're an anti-Walmart activist, if you want to sort of, leverage your political power against the company, it involves in some ways explaining to a poor person why a $28 DVD player is a bad thing. And, how do you do that? And that's a serious question. And I think this question is raised more and more in the book. I talk about it as Walmart pushes into urban markets. And this is something you see, for instance, in the Austin neighborhood in Chicago, where, Walmart's trying to go in, and it's a the site where they want to go in is a, I think it's an abandoned candy factory. Hmm. And so how do you explain to that neighborhood that has a really high unemployment rate, from what I understand, that, actually an abandoned candy factory is better than a Walmart supercenter? How do you explain that, low-paying non-union jobs are better or are worse than no job at all? And so that's the complexity of kind of the Walmart political puzzle, especially as they move more and more into urban markets, which they have to do because that's where the majority of money is on retailing. The retail dollars are spent in this country as in the top 100 urban markets. And because Walmart was initially a rural company and then a kind of exurban company, that was their base, was in the outskirts of towns, and that they're now going in for the kill into the cities. That's an imperative, and that's why it's getting complex. The other thing that I should mention that Walmart has done in terms of kind of trying to influence people in high places is they've done a lot of outreach to African American and Latino groups. For instance, they've contributed heavily to the NAACP and the United Negro College Fund, I think to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus as well. So, you don't see as many leaders of kind of black leaders or Latino leaders really challenging the company in that respect. And then the other point that a writer in the LA Weekly made that's really interesting, I thought, was that in these kind of urban communities where they're going into in poor neighborhoods, there's not the same sort of sentimentality about the local business owner, for example, because there's not as many local businesses, and how sentimental do you get about the liquor store or the check cashing place? And another thing, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that Walmart offers services that that really help poor people in terms of check cashing. You won't ever pay more to get your check cashed than $3 at a Walmart store. They also do money wiring services that are cheaper than their competitors. So, on one level, this kind of endears them to their base customer who lives paycheck to paycheck. On the other hand, it's savvy business, because where else would you want to have a worker cash his or her paycheck than in a Walmart?
We have some other callers to talk with. Let's do that. Next, we have someone in Champagne on our line number two. Hello.
Hi. Great to hear you this morning. Interesting issues so far. Let me put a little different spin on things. I work with some folks in the grocery industry, and they have felt that the Walmart strategy is to do, well, kind of what's going on here in Champaign-Urbana. We've got one Walmart with a Sam's, then we got a second Walmart, a big superstore. We got a brand new superstore up in North Champaign. We're building one in Urbana, just about 20 miles away in Rantoul. There's another superstore, and the feeling in the grocery industry is that Walmart saturates a community with the specific intent of driving out all competitors and big competitors, not just your little local small business owner, but one strategy, for example, is every Meijer superstore is going to have a Walmart across the street, and they're specifically targeting that company, is what I understand. And once they drive out the competition, then the overall strategic plan is then to close down a bunch of the superstores and have basically smaller, maybe about a third the size, stores to serve the community. And I was just kind of wondering if you'd heard anything about that. Is that way off the mark? Is that really part of their master plan? And if it is, what does that say about the whole idea that competition is always good, because competition's goal eventually is to crush the competition and be the sole survivor? So that's a whole bunch of stuff. I'm just wondering if my sources are on track or off, and what you might think about that. And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Well, what can you say about that, John?
Well, no, it's a great point, and I think that, you know, Walmart certainly does want to dominate the markets they're in. And, you know, they've done this in Dallas is a good example, Houston's a good example, New Orleans is starting to be a good example of that, Orlando is an excellent example. I wish I remember, I was at the shareholders meeting, Walmart shareholders meeting, and their CFO, Tom Schoe, had a really great Orwellian term for this, because, you know, some people, they don't like the term cannibalization, you know, where one store sales are you know, eating another store's sales, because they look at it in the overall picture of the market. So, yes, they do this. I have not heard that they have any intention of intentionally closing down super centers and replacing them with smaller stores, though it should be noted they have and have been working on for a decade now, a smaller plan, that some people are a smaller template store that's called, some people call it a small mart, but it's actually called a Walmart neighborhood store. And these are kind of like mainly grocery stores. They'd be kind of like a small Safeway or Albertsons. I don't know what your kind of dominant supermarket chain is out in Champaign, Urbana. But it's kind of looks more like a traditional grocery store, because its main item is food. And these are usually about three times the size of a 7-Eleven. But yes, they are willing to take, you know, loss at one store to kind of overall, you know, dominate a market. And indeed, the caller was absolutely right that they're far more worried about the Albertsons or the Meijer than they are about, you know, Ed's Variety Store downtown. That's their real competition. That's who they're kind of competing with on a national level for market share, are the big companies like Safeway and Albertsons and Kroger. But what you mentioned, which is so interesting, what I think fuels an interesting opposition to Walmart, particularly in exurban and suburban places where you wouldn't think, you know, in places that you wouldn't think would be hotbeds of anti-Walmart activity, is the sense that we already have enough retail options, right? I can go down the street to Walmart. I can, you know, travel a mile to Safeway or to my grocery store. Why do I need another Walmart supercenter, you know, 3 miles away or 5 miles away? And this is, you know, kind of a non-ideological position, and it's based on kind of the overstoring, not just with Walmart, but for retail in general, that's happened in this country. I think, you know, there's one article, I believe it was in Forbes, that showed that retail, the amount of square footage of retail has grown faster than the population in the last 20 years. So it's sometimes the Walmart debate in a particular community, whether it's being resisted or not, has a lot to do with what does a new Walmart offer us that we don't already have. And, you know, in the book I talk about, you know, communities that are pretty conservative, you know, Monument, Colorado, Union County, South Carolina, West Springfield, Illinois, that are taking on Walmart, but not for ideological reasons, The people who kind of work on these campaigns are motivated by the fact that they don't want their real estate devalued by a super center next door, or they don't want to deal with the traffic. It's not because they have a grand political vision that Walmart interferes with. You know, some of the people I talked to in Monument, Colorado, for instance, would say, hey, you know, I shop at Sam's Club, but I'm against this particular Walmart on my street for these three reasons. So it's a very interesting, diverse debate that I think really kind of puts the kind of traditional left-right political alliances into a blender sometimes.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, John Dicker. He's a writer based in Denver. His work has been published in a variety of places, including The Nation, Salon, other alternative news weeklies. His first book is The United States of Walmart, and it's published by Tarcher Penguin in paperback. So if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. Questions, comments are welcome, certainly here on the show. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to pick up very quickly on one point that you mentioned in passing, while you said that it was true that Walmart, in terms of targeting competitors, is really concerned with very big ones. They're not all that concerned with Ed's Variety, down on the main street of the town. In fact, the presence of Walmart in a lot of towns has destroyed stores like Ed's Variety. So perhaps that they may not have targeted them deliberately, but it is the case that a lot of smaller, particularly independent retailers, have been driven out of business because they simply can't compete.
Right. And I think this is what alarms people. You know, I've even read stuff about, the conservative case against Walmart. And one of the things they argued is that Walmart kind of creates these huge obstacles to enter the marketplace. And if you look at retail, if you look at general merchandise retailers, name one that has, that's a mass merchant that really started after 1962. You know what I mean? The 1962 is the pivotal year. That was when Kmart came out, when Dayton Hudson introduced Target, when Walmart opened its first store in Arkansas. And what you've seen in retail is not a kind of letting a thousand flowers bloom. You've seen a massive consolidation. And in big box with big box retail, you see this. Every product category has a chain that kind of dominates it. Maybe one or two. Office supplies, it's Staples or Office Max. With books, Borders, and Barnes and Noble. You go down the list. And so the kind of Walmartization of America doesn't leave a lot of room for individual initiative and enterprise. The other thing that's interesting that Walmart likes to pride itself, when they're disputed in a community, when the community is giving them trouble and doesn't want them there, they like to frame the issue about being about consumer choice. That Walmart's opponents are just a kind of vocal minority, and that they're why do they want to deny you, the consumer, the right to choose where to shop? This recently backfired for them this spring in Flagstaff, Arizona, where they actually ran a newspaper ad that showed Nazis in Berlin burning books, and basically likened that to the opposition, that if you oppose Walmart, you're against choice and therefore a de facto fascist. Well, the Walmart flack who authorized that ad got fired, and it really had a negative effect. But this is kind of the way the issue is framed.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Next, Champagne Line 3. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of things I wanted to ask about. I've read a few articles, and there were a couple of shows on PBS about Walmart. And so I have a limited knowledge about this, but I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One is with regard to unions. I know that they have been rigorously trying to avoid having any unionization. I think I read an article in the Times at one point that they'd bring in big-time lawyers from around the country the first day, quite literally by plane, that there was any rumor of unionization in any store, something to that effect. The other thing is I saw that they had crushed apparently Rubbermaid, back in the mid-90s, when the cost of a certain chemical or something used in the rubber had gone up, and Rubbermaid wanted to raise the prices slightly, and Kmart said no, and Vlasic Pickles, a very similar situation, where I think they may have gone out of business recently as well, because they had something like a 5-gallon jar that they were being selling for 99 cents temporarily, and Walmart said you do it permanently or else, you know, and apparently they're supposedly going bankrupt. And what I also heard was that this sort of targeting of this kind of activity, but also that they're actually not that cheap, that they practice something, I forget the name of it, low tagging or something, where they will select specific items that are cheap, but otherwise they're actually not very cheap. And so the public gets this image of the cheapness of Walmart, the legendary cheapness with commercials, et cetera, et cetera. And when in fact they're not very cheap, and the corporation itself, of course, in opposing unionization, they actually instruct their workers, at least historically, I don't know about right now, but how to get government assistance. So we as taxpayers are helping to pay for Walmart's success, in a sense, which I found outrageous. The other thing I wonder is there an alternative to this? Because Costco, which is throughout the United States, though not in Champaign, unfortunately, Costco allows unionization, has a completely different approach. There was a large piece in the New York Times recently about this, and having quite a bit of success as well in Korea and Japan and so on. So I'd be interested in seeing what you think about these opportunities for other approaches to retailization and the possible success, because Costco apparently is quite cheap, its products and so on, but it does allow unions. And so I found that extremely interesting.
Well,
I'll just get off the line.
You've asked enough questions to keep us going for the next week. Yes, I was going to say for the rest of the show, but yes. Well, can you try to talk a little bit about those things?
Sure. The union issue is something it's also incredibly complex, because the labor movement, you know, the American labor movement is a kind of historic weak point, and they're trying to tackle a company that has never been bigger. You know what I mean? When you think about some of the historic labor battles have been, you know, in steel or in auto, where you might have a big company that had only maybe half a dozen kind of sites, work sites, so you could really focus your energy. Walmart, you know, has, I forget how many U.S. stores, I think it's around 3,500, 3,600. The number keeps changing, so that's why it's hard to keep track of. But the idea of, you know, trying to tackle each store individually, I mean, the amount of research, you could spend your entire budget, you know, just dealing with Walmart, and at the end of the year have, you know, not organized a store. But Walmart does take, you know, unions very seriously. If their workers express interest, if there's talk of it, they do fly in their, you know, kind of labor team from Bentonville to the store. And, you know, Walmart claims it's to educate its associates about labor law and to educate its management on what they can and can't do. But there's pretty much a solid track record that, like many other employers, they create a climate of fear in the workplace, so that at the, you know, even if you were the person who wanted a union from the beginning, after, you know, all the, you know, kind of captive audience meetings that you have, they have to go in and listen to how unions only want your money, yada yada yada. And having, you know, organized, it's not like, you know, the union people can come into the store and make their case at it either. You know, it's not a fair dialogue. The break room is set up with anti-union propaganda, videos are shown, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, you know, eventually they beat people down. The other big thing they do is that, you know, two examples of this. One, in 2000, in, I think it was Jacksonville, Texas, the butchers, the meat cutters, it was a unit of about, I think there were 11 of them, and they voted to organize. Well, a few weeks later, Walmart announced that it was switching switching from cut meat, you know, a skilled position, to case-ready or pre-cut meat. And so that kind of eliminated these people's jobs, in effect. They were given other positions within Walmart, but it eliminated their bargaining unit. And then more recently, this spring, in Jonquière, Canada, a store that organized was closed, and Walmart, you know, they closed the store once this store voted to join the United Food and Commercial Workers. Walmart claimed it was because the store was performing poorly. You know, if you believe, you could believe that, but, you know, it what these things do is it sends, it's like a memo to its workforce saying that this is what you can expect if you try to organize. You know, one of the union organizers I talked to, who was a retired UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers guy, said that the difference, you know, what the difference at organizing Walmart workers versus workers anywhere else is that they really know what they're up against. They know, you know, they've heard about these instances in Canada and Texas, and they know, you know, it creates an environment of fear and hopelessness.
some of the other questions of, is there a, you know, an alternative model to Walmart? Sure, you know, Costco is a good example. However, you have to look at Costco, and it's not the same model. Even though it's often compared to Walmart, it's a club store where people pay, you know, about $40. I think it's $40 a year, and you know, to have the right to shop there. And it won't give you everything. And when you go to Costco, you know you're going to spend a lot of time there. Generally, you spend, I think it's about between $60 and $100 more per visit to Costco compared to a regular kind of superstore or grocery store. Because, you know, it's the type of place you go to, you know, you try to go to once every 2 or 3 weeks, as opposed to Walmart, where people will go, you know, considerably more often. So it's not the same exact retail model. So it can't be compared to it exactly. But at the same time, yes, it does, you know, it does treat its employees as a different ethic and different set of values in terms of treating their employees. You know, I think a Costco worker who's been there for 3 years can make around $40,000 and above, and I think most of their workers are covered for health insurance. And as a result, they don't have the same kind of employee turnover that Walmart does. They have about 15% of their stores are unionized. They will, you know, if their workers at a non-unionized store try to organize, they will be resisted. But what happens, you know, with stores like this, when part of their workforce is organized, they make sure their non-union stores are paying, you know, have the same wages and benefits as the union stores, and that usually, you know, quells the insurgency, so to speak. I know you had another point, but
maybe I'll ask about one other, because I think this is the kind of thing that also people perhaps have heard stories about, and that is the fact that Walmart is so big. And if it's going to buy some particular product to put on the shelves, it's going to buy so much of it that it can go to the manufacturer of the product and say, this is what we want and this is what we will pay for it. And that then that manufacturer either has to give Walmart the product at the price that they want, or Walmart can just say, well, fine, we're gone, we're out of here, we'll go someplace else. And that Walmart is such a big customer that manufacturers simply cannot afford to say no. And they have to deal with the Walmart and pay whatever Walmart says they will pay for whatever it is, whether we're talking about toilet paper or rubber trash cans or, you know, whatever it is.
Right. And yeah, there's examples of, you know, there's examples like companies like Master Lock had to, you know, move offshore to kind of meet the demand of companies like Walmart. Pillowtex in Kannapolis, North Carolina was another one that really, you know, kind of credited Walmart as the reason that they're no longer doing, you know, making apparel in the States. So there's, you know, there's tons of examples of this, sure. And, you know, Walmart is famous for kind of upsetting the cozy relationship that merchandisers have with retailers. You know, there's no kind of business lunch, so to speak, that you go into these buying rooms, which are fluorescently lit and are fairly small. And, you know, the Walmart's buyer, who's someone who I think, you know, will make, you know, I've heard the figures of something like the buyer might make $50,000 a year and have a buying budget of, you know, $500 million. Don't quote me on the exact numbers there, but that you get the idea. Mm-hmm. And their first question to anyone who wants to sell to Walmart is, so what can you do, you know, for Walmart? The amount of power, you know, that Walmart has is kind of on display at the Walmart shareholders meeting, which is held, you know, every June in Fayetteville, Arkansas, at the Bud Walton Arena, where the University of Arkansas basketball team plays. And if you haven't, you know, seen it, it's kind of like Triumph of the Will meets Hee-Haw meets the Academy Awards. I mean, there's just thousands of people, you know, Walmart contingents from all their different countries, like the United Kingdom, Korea, China, Mexico. You just watch them all file in, like, you know, the Olympic opening ceremonies. But the way that their power is on display there is in terms of, if you go to the Walmart shareholders meeting, and for people who, you know, for Walmart associates who go, it's often kind of like a week-long event. But when I was there, you know, Wednesday night, the shareholders meeting was on Friday. On Wednesday night was a private concert for Walmart associates and shareholders only, featuring Will Smith. So Will Smith was doing a concert just for Walmart shareholders and workers. Thursday night, same thing, but it was Jimmy Buffett who was performing. Then at the shareholders meeting itself, you have Jessica Simpson singing the national anthem. You have John Bon Jovi playing a couple of songs. You have the penguins from the movie, the DreamWorks film Madagascar. Mm-hmm. Those animated Pixar penguins. They made a special short film of the penguins doing the Walmart cheer. And then closing it out was Garth Brooks, who played a few songs. So, and these, the important thing to note here is that Walmart doesn't pay these people to come there. You know, they come willingly, or they're sent by their record companies because they know, you know, where their bread gets buttered in this country.
Yeah. We have about 15 minutes left. Well, maybe more like 10 or 12. And our guest is John Dicker. He's a writer based in Denver. His work has been published in Nation, Salon, and other alternative news weeklies. His first book is The United States of Walmart. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. Other callers here with questions. We'll go next to Normal, and that's line four. Hello.
Yes. You mentioned the union attempt in California. Could you explain what happened on that?
I'm not sure which in California, which store are we talking about?
Well, it was a store that the employees attempted to form a union.
I'm actually not familiar.
I thought that there was one in near Los Angeles that they attempted to organize and that I guess was unsuccessful in their attempts to organize a union.
Right. Yeah. No. I wish I could speak to that particular case, but I'm not sure. I've heard too much about it. I mean, the big one, you know, more recently has been the Canadian store, also because Walmart A is the largest retailer in Canada, and B, Canada's labor laws are generally more friendly to workers and unions than here in the States.
And in Canada they were unsuccessful, were they?
Well, they were unsuccessful the first time, and then the second time they were successful, and shortly thereafter, Walmart closed the store, saying that it couldn't do business, it couldn't operate profitably, with the union and their unreasonable demands.
Are there any stores in the U.S. that have unions? Do you know?
Walmart stores, no.
Okay.
They're not.
So all attempts have failed at this point in time.
Yes. Yes, that is unfortunate.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's go to caller here, line number one, Spring Bay. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of weeks ago, Celeste Quinn had on James Howard Kunstler, and he was talking about his book, The Long Emergency. And in that, he made a couple of points about Walmart that I'd like your guest to comment on. One was he used the illustration that to save a couple of bucks on a hair dryer, we have ruined a whole class of people in this country, which would be the small retail business, and that these are people who would be on the school board and were civic-minded and that sort of thing, and we're really kind of ripping up part of that fabric. And then his second point is that Walmart has sort of a natural dynamics about it because of the 12,000-mile supply line, and it is a phenomena that is completely dependent on cheap oil and gas, and when that is gone, Walmart will diminish. So I'd like your guest to comment on those, if you would, please, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, yeah, Walmart, you can see that how concerned, you know, Walmart is with energy costs because, you know, when their stock price in recent years has been kind of floundering. And one of the things that Lee Scott, their CEO, consistently points to is gas prices. And not only in terms of Walmart, you know, trucking its products around the country and, you know, around the world, but also in terms of, you know, their customers who are paying more. You know, if you live paycheck to paycheck, as they rightly note, you know, an increase in gas, you know, by 25 cents, 50 cents, now practically a dollar, you know, means a lot more than if you're, you know, if you have a lot more disposable income. So that's and then the other thing that, interestingly enough, that Lee Scott has mentioned a few times is how he drives a Volkswagen Bug, and that he's, you know, into the idea of fuel efficiency. But yeah, their model is heavily dependent on fossil fuel, you know, and petroleum. They are, you know, I know they're looking into other things in terms of, you know, in terms of their supply line, for instance, when the West Coast dock workers were the longshoremen were locked out in it was the fall of 2003, I believe, or the late summer of 2003. All the container ports just started stacking up on the West Coast docks, and you know, all the manufacturers and the, or the retailers were just, you know, not knowing what to do. Well, one of the things Walmart has put, you know, starting to put in place is kind of creating an alternative to that through Houston. They're building these huge distribution centers so that container port ships can go in that way. I don't know if they have a whole kind of contingency alternative energy plan, but you know, in some ways I wouldn't be surprised, because they're a company that constantly thinks ahead, and you know, a lot of their executives in interviews have said, and I don't have reason to doubt it, which is that we're the world's largest company with the world's largest inferiority complex, and this idea of constant improvement and constant change. Sam Walton called it the LRC, low resistance to change, and I think that is kind of embedded in their corporate DNA. And I think, you know, I don't know if that, does that mean they can solve, you know, the global energy crisis? Probably not. But does that mean that they're thinking ahead, you know, and how to deal with it? You know, sure. One of the things that I should mention, that, you know, in Lee Scott's speech in June at the shareholders meeting, he mentioned, you know, he talked about this, why his same store sales figures weren't doing as well as other, you know, retailers. And same store sales, just so you know, are just stores that have been opened a year or more, so not new stores. And he said that he actually, it was kind of baffling. He claimed that, you know, the current tax policies have given more disposable income to wealthier Americans who tend not to shop at Walmart as much as poorer Americans, whose their core customer, as they say, who lives paycheck to paycheck, whose disposable income has shrunk in recent years. And so the result, you know, it's interesting that they're criticizing, you know, the Bush administration's tax policy, because they're a company that has gone from, you know, spending almost nothing on politics to being, you know, a very large contributor overwhelmingly to the Republican Party. And here they are kind of vaguely criticizing, you know, the tax policy. But, here's the but, the implications, if you're Walmart, to this kind of economic shift in wealth is not to, you know, it's not populist revolution or, you know, supporting another political party. It's making your product mix more relevant to upper-income customers without alienating or losing your core kind of poor customer. So that's what Walmart is thinking about these days, is how can we make our product mix a little bit kind of more appealing to, say, a Target shopper. You know, another thing to note, Walmart hired away Target's marketing person. I forget the guy's name, but they've noted Advertising Age, I think, had a piece on how Walmart's ads look a lot more like Target's ads in, you know, just recently, whereas Walmart's traditional ad would always, you know, be in the store. Now they're kind of more abstract and more just the product. And so I think that's, you know, where you're seeing that shift, and you'll probably see more of it.
We have a couple of minutes left and two callers trying to get at least one more in. Urbana here, line three. Hello.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame that people don't get the full import of what Walmart represents, and it doesn't look like they ever will, both in terms of what it means for labor and in terms of what it means for all this willingness to think this aw shucks appeal is really ought to be dumped. But I just had one quick question. Can you speak in terms of what percentage of all retail in the U.S. is in Walmart? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, that's a good question. And Walmart, you know, retail is huge. And Walmart actually, and this might surprise people, Walmart, I think, has about 10% of total retail sales, which might not, you know, when you think about what we've been talking about, you'd think it was, you know, 80 or 90, but it's only, you know, 10%. But, you know, in certain markets, you know, and in certain product categories, you know, they'll rule the roost. But in the overall picture of retail, which encompasses, you know, anytime you spend money at any store, that's retail. You spend money online at Amazon, that's retail. They occupy 10%. But, you know, they have plenty of room to grow in this country, and they have plenty of room to grow, particularly in countries like China. Not just, you know, most people talk about Walmart in China in terms of manufacturing, but they're actually putting a lot more emphasis on their super centers and rolling those out throughout China. So, yeah, it is kind of surprising that that overall they don't occupy a higher percentage.
We've got to stop, and unfortunately, I can give you about a minute. I want to come back to this issue of the captive audience and what one can say to those people who have to shop at Walmart because either that's the place or they feel it's the pressure of having to get what they need for themselves and their families at the lowest possible price. I mean, how do you address that? What do you say to those people?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know that that might sound like a cop-out, but I don't know. I did a blog on this at the HuffingtonPost.com website, and these people were very thoughtful people were writing in response and saying, well, what you do is you talk about how much the CEO makes and try to play on class resentment. But I don't think that really plays in the face of a $30 DVD player. I think, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, what is an activist offering you that Walmart, that Walmart isn't? So it's an incredibly complex question, but, that has to be, it's a dialogue that started in this country and we don't exactly know where it ends. But, I think talking about it in general is a good thing and mentioning it to Walmart workers and Walmart store managers, if they're feeling this from their customers, they're going to listen. Hey, I'm concerned about this. I do think that, that has value. I know that might sound like, a kind of a cop-out response, but it's an incredibly complex social and political question that I don't think anyone has a solid answer to.
Well, if people want to read more, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's The United States of Walmart by our guest, John Dicker. He's a writer based in Denver. He's published in The Nation, Salon, other alternative news weeklies. And this book, published by Torture Penguin, is his first. And John, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast today is also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Just a quick reminder that tomorrow morning on the program, in hour number one, we'll be talking about biodiesel, and our guest for the show will be Greg Paul. He's a freelance writer and journalist who has authored a book on the subject, and then also we'll be talking about the future of American organized labor, paying particular attention to some of the recent controversy and problems involving the AFL-CIO. That's tomorrow in hour number two. We are here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions, comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon, or good morning, coming up on afternoon, isn't it? Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with former University of Illinois professor Brian Wansink. He's now at Cornell. He's interested in why we eat what we eat. He's interested in how ads, packaging, and personality traits influence what we buy and eat. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. They're higher today. September wheat, 320.5, up 1. December, 334.75, up 1/4. September corn, 221.5, up 2 and 3/4.